Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of our podcast series, AGG Talks Antitrust and White Collar Criminal Roundup, in which we cover the legal facts surrounding the recent cases, trends, and hot topics related to antitrust and white collar crime with some of the foremost legal analysts in the country. My name is Jeff Jacobowitz. I am a trial attorney with Arnell Golden Gregory, and I chair the antitrust group. I have recently appeared on CNN and ITV regarding white-collar crime issues related to Donald Trump's indictments. I'm joined today by Cynthia Alksny, a career federal prosecutor, MSNBC legal analyst, and expert on criminal law, grand jury, and police investigations, and confrontational interviewing techniques. Cynthia has handled cases involving weeks of grand jury investigations and live testimony leading to dozens of indictments. She's here with me today to analyze the recent indictments in D.C. and Georgia of former President Donald Trump on charges related to attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Cynthia and I will discuss the D.C. and Georgia indictments in relation to other indictments brought against Donald Trump, the charges he is facing in D.C. and Georgia, and his alleged co-conspirators, and Fulton County District Attorney Fawny Willis. Cynthia, thank you very much for joining us once again. Let's get started. When we started out to plan this program, Cynthia, we were just going to do the January 6th indictment. And in the interim, another indictment is hit, the Georgia indictment. How would you compare the January 6th D.C. and Georgia indictments of Donald Trump to his other indictments?
Well, it's mostly an approach because the fact patterns really do overlap. You know, if you were thinking about a Venn diagram, you don't have a lot. It doesn't overlap in terms of facts, but they're completely different approaches. The DC approach is really designed for speed. It's designed to get the case to trial. Donald Trump is the only defendant. It's a simple 371 conspiracy with obstruction and then the civil rights conspiracy. So there's only four charges. There are unindicted co-conspirators, but only six of them. But they're unindicted, or at least they're not named in this indictment. They could be indicted, but they're not named in this indictment.
Do you think they will be indicted, by the way?
I think they absolutely will be indicted. For me, the question is whether or not they're indicted already and it's sealed, or whether or not they'll be indicted later. But I definitely think they will be indicted. In the actually wording of the indictment, it doesn't call them unindicted co-conspirators. That's so tempting because we sort of grew up in the Nixon era, and you know, and you think about era and we think about unindicted co-conspirators as a term of art almost. But in the Jack Smith indictment, he doesn't call them unindicted co-conspirators. He just calls them co-conspirator one, co-conspirator two. And he doesn't make a statement that they're unindicted. I do think they will be indicted. It's a basically straightforward case factually. And I think it will go to trial relatively soon. Maybe not as soon as January, which is what Jack Smith likes, but it will go shortly thereafter. The Georgia case is totally different. It is not designed for speed. It is designed for chronological completeness. There are 19 co-defendants, and you know, it's a 100-page indictment. There are 100 and some acts listed in chronological order. All of those acts have to be proven, and then every witness who testifies is going to be cross-examined by all these lawyers. It's going to take a very long time to get that case in a position where it's ready for trial. But it is complete. It does tell the entire historical story about what happened and the people that are involved.
And not just in Georgia, isn't that right?
Yeah, there are some mentions, not as completely as you might think, you know, in a federal indictment, but there are mentions about what was happening in Arizona and Michigan and some in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of commentary that one of the unindicted co-conspirators in the Georgia case is Doug Mastriano. We'll see if that plays out down the end. But yes, that's the beauty of it doing as a RICO. Even though she is based in Georgia, she can bring in other states. So it's pretty complicated to present that big a case with that many defendants.
And when you say 19 defendants, is it realistic that in the end there will not be 19? Some people will plead out, for example, and ultimately a fewer will go to trial. And could there be severance along the way also?
There could be severance, but I think more likely there will be pleas and that people will take plea agreements that require their testimony. The RICO statute is sort of built that way to encourage that. And my guess is that's what happens. There's a whittling down of defendants, but each of those defendants will end up testifying against upper level defendants.
And the RICO statute in Georgia is a 5-year mandatory minimum offense, isn't it? Although there are some ways of getting around that through the prosecutor and the judge.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange quirk that we're just learning about in Georgia law. The statute says it's a 5-year mandatory minimum, but apparently in Georgia, there are legal ways around it. If the statute doesn't also say, and the judge can never give probation, and it doesn't say that, it just says it's a 5-year mandatory minimum. So we'll have to wait and see down the road what happens with that. But it's certainly, if you are a criminal defendant and you're looking at a conviction and you've never had a conviction before, and you were kind of tricked as a fake elector to sign certificates that said you were a duly elected elector when you know you weren't, the idea that you're having to roll the dice on whether or not the judge will help you out on a statute that says 5-year mandatory minimum is pretty bleak. So it will encourage police.
Well, that's interesting also, because if it's the judge making that determination, and frequently it is, will Donald Trump criticize the judge in his tweets, as he's been doing with other judges in his indictment?
Well, I think at some point he will, because that's just his MO. I mean, without getting into the politics of it, the judge was appointed by a rival. How he handles it, I do not know. We'll just have to wait and see.
Right. In terms of the Georgia RICO counts, why do you think Fannie Willis brought it that way?
I think she brought it that way for completeness. First of all, this is not unusual for her. She's brought RICO counts against quite a few other groups, and it's an amazing tool. When you have a common scheme, you have this big umbrella, and you can bring in all the different parts of the scheme, whether or not they're in Georgia or Arizona or Michigan, to tell the jury and the members of the public the full story. It's a very effective and complete tool to get the evidence and tell the story about what happened, and she's good at it.
And what about the January 6th indictment? The judge there has had prior January 6th cases, isn't that correct?
She has, and she's been pretty tough on those defendants, sometimes even sentencing them to more time than was requested by the Department of Justice. But she's a pretty straight up judge. She's got a lot of trial experience. She was a defense attorney for a long time. Not only does she have trial experience by trying her own cases, but also a lot of cases in her courtroom. She has a great reputation in D.C. as somebody who's fair and no nonsense.
Right. She's a former public defender.
You're right. And she was also at the Boies law firm, too.
Oh, that's right. And I guess they do plaintiff's cases frequently, but they defend as well. And what about getting back to Jack Smith's indictment in D.C.? What are the advantages of having either unindicted or co-conspirators not being named at this point?
The biggest advantage is getting the case to trial. And it's clear that Jack Smith's indictment is built for speed. He wants to get the indictment to in front of a Pettit jury as soon as possible, and preferably before the election. And that's why it looks to me it's done that way.
And when you have 19 defendants, you have 19 lawyers filing motions, and Mark Meadows already filed a motion for removal. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Mark Meadows is trying to take advantage of a statute which says if you're a federal officer and you're sued in state court for a crime that happened in the course and scope of your employment, the allegation is in the course of scope in your employment, and you have a federal defense, that can be removed to federal court. And behind that is maybe the states aren't as fair to federal officers. It's a post-Civil War statute. Mark Meadows' problem is that the allegations are not only that he was making phone calls and doing things for Trump as a chief of staff, but those things were often campaign-related and not really chief of staff duties. I mean, what we know is that the president of the United States is not responsible for the manner in which states run their elections. He has no role in that, nor he should have any role in that, because he's the one who's, you know, up for election. So many of the allegations have to do or campaign related. There's a particular one that's my favorite, which is Act 96, where he's actually calling the state investigator. Meadows calls the state investigator, and according to the indictment, says he's looking for a way to speed up the Fulton County signature verification process before January 6th, and perhaps maybe even the Trump campaign could help pay for it. That isn't the work of a chief of staff. And that's his problem when it comes to removal. He has every right to do it, but that doesn't mean, even though he applies, he's going to win. Now, one of the advantages of a removal is time and delay. A defendant has 30 days from the time of the indictment to file a removal petition. Then once the removal petition gets to the federal judge, unless it's really obvious and the federal judge just rejects it, there's going to be briefing, there is a hearing, and it's going to take a while. So as we know, one of the strategies of the lawyers for Trump has always been delay, delay, delay. This is a vehicle for them to use that. And I expect they will move for his removal to federal court.
Although in the federal cases, it's clear the strategy is delay, delay, delay. And ultimately, if Trump or another Republican is elected president, they're looking for a pardon or a dismissal from the attorney general. If a state case ends up being delayed and the president cannot pardon state defendants, what is the advantage of going to federal court?
Well, even if it goes to federal court, it's still under state law. Fannie Willis will still be the prosecutor. But the jury pool will not only be Fulton County, which is heavily Democratic, but will include some of the collar counties in the north, which, by the way, are not red Republican, but it does widen the jury pool. So that's an advantage, or at least they think it's an advantage. That's one thing. And the other is maybe it won't go to trial quite so quickly. And the big thing is there'll be no cameras in the courtroom. So right. In Georgia, there's always cameras in the courtroom. The minute you get into federal court, forget it. There's no cameras. So it's my feeling that the Trump lawyers do not want cameras in the courtroom, and that would achieve the goal.
And if the case is removed to federal court, assuming that Donald Trump also moves for removal, Fannie Willis can still try the case. Isn't that correct?
No, Fannie Willis will try the case there, or her first assistant. She has a first assistant who's very experienced in RICO cases who may be the one who tries the case. Maybe they do it together. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows yet. But it would be the DA's office trying the case, and it would be under Georgia law.
And she's brought a number of RICO indictments before.
Oh, yeah, she has. It's obviously one of her favorite statutes, and she's been very open about it, not only for this case, but in cases involving some rap stars and cases involving like a teacher's union. So she's used in a wide variety of cases.
Did you notice that in the Georgia indictment, there are a number of unindicted co-conspirators as well?
Yes, there are about 30.
And presumably those 30 were people who have cooperated. Isn't that accurate?
Maybe. I think it's too early to tell. Either they've cooperated, she wants them to cooperate and thinks this will push them to do that. I don't know enough about the manner in which she does that, her personal manner. It's possible. In fact, maybe it's probable, but it isn't a certainty.
Well, it's interesting also in reading the indictment, which is, as you mentioned, very detailed. They had a lot of people, they being Georgia, had a lot of people on the inside providing information. People were at meetings and so forth. And so you can tell from the indictment that they have a lot of inside information.
Right. I would say that's definitely true. And I've heard a lot of commentators use the word granular. I think that's a pretty good word for the way she's dialed into this, everything that's happened. And it's a very easy read. I would recommend anybody read it. It's easy to find. You know, it's about 100-page indictment, but it's 40 or 50 pages of this fact pattern that reads like a novel. And it starts with Trump announcing on election night that he has won the election when there is no evidence that he's actually won. And it continues into 2021. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I guess an open legal issue may be whether a president or a former president, rather, who gets reelected, if he's under indictment at the time pending trial, can you take an acting president or the current president to trial? Because we dealt with that previously with the DOJ's policy and not indicting a sitting president. What happens if that president has been indicted already and is about to go to trial and then gets elected president?
Oh, you mean the Georgia case?
Georgia case, yeah.
Here's what's up in the air about it. So the Department of Justice has taken the position as a federal matter that we cannot prosecute a sitting president. What's up in the air is, can a state prosecute a sitting president? The Department of Justice has never said anything about that, and the Supreme Court is not either. So that's up in the air.
Well, Cynthia, we're almost out of time. So I guess, is there anything else you want to tell the audience here about the Georgia indictment that you found interesting and different than the other indictments?
No, I think they're very complementary of each other. I'm interested to see whether or not if Jack Smith does either supersede or goes ahead and indicts the other people. But as he develops his case, does that inform Fannie Willis so that she supersedes her indictment and brings in other evidence? I think it will be interesting to see the interplay between the two as the fact patterns develop. And I'm looking forward to that. But my guess is that even though maybe for history, because Fannie Willis is so granular, hers is very important, it's going to take a long time to get there. In the immediate future, Jack Smith's indictment is the one that will determine, I think, the fate of the president.
And there's still the Mar-a-Lago indictment. Is that correct?
Right. My guess is the Mar-a-Lago indictment, it is postponed and postponed until after Jack Smith. And the indictment in New York City, Bragg has already said he will defer to the other indictments to go forward. So right. It really is the next serious trial on the docket is the Jack Smith indictment.
Well, Cynthia, I want to thank you once again for joining us. And listeners, we hope that you found the discussion to be informative. If you have any questions or would like to submit your feedback or topics for future podcasts, please feel free to reach out to me, Jeff Jacobowitz. You can find my contact information at agg.com. Future podcast episodes will be distributed through our AGG website and social media pages. Thank you again, Cynthia, for joining us.
Thank you.